Hi, my name's Jackie. I probably know quite a few people here, but every week I seem to come along and not recognise at least half the people, so I thought I'd better introduce myself a little bit, just to the people that don't know me. I've been coming to Good Life since the beginning of 2007. I moved up from Sydney to work with an organisation called Mercy Ministries that used to be up here on the coast. It was an organisation I worked with for 5 years that worked with girls from quite broken backgrounds. A lot of girls coming out of sexual abuse kind of situations, eating disorders, self-harm, depression, that kind of stuff. So I've been really privileged to see God do some incredible things in people's lives. For the last couple of years, when that program isn't running anymore, but I took some time out to travel overseas, did some baking in a little cafe, and now I'm working for the Department of Housing, so that's all new. I'm someone who likes to keep things real, and I'm constantly trying to work out what it means to live in this world and follow Jesus and trust him and work out how to care about the things that he cares about. I don't believe that Christianity is a formula, but I do believe in relationship with Jesus. So, yeah, I guess I think, you know, your thoughts and beliefs about God are always getting worked out, and how you express and how you give expression to what God's doing in your heart, it's always changing and evolving. And, yeah, I'm someone that likes to think about things, question things, you know, because I want to be relevant, and I don't want to be someone that does damage in Jesus' name. And I think, you know, a lot of us will have had experiences in the church or have heard things even throughout history where people with really good intentions actually hurt people. So I'm always trying to think about how I can not be one of those people. Tim's asked me to continue on through the book of John, and tonight we're up to John chapter 12. So you can follow along in your Bibles if you can see them. But I'm just going to read that out and then talk a little bit about some of my thoughts. I've tried to do study and tried to be accurate and tried not to put too much of my opinion in things. I am a bit of an opinionated person, but I've tried not to put too much of myself in. But as always, when Tim preaches, you can't speak without putting some of your opinion and some of your slant on things. So it's okay if I don't get it 100% right, that's okay. I'm not pretending to have it all right. Okay, so John chapter 12. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived at Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honour. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. Okay, this story is also told in Mark 14 and Matthew 26. John has a few more details. In the other books where this story is written, Mary and Martha aren't mentioned by name, and they're at Simon's house, whereas in this story we sort of presume that they're at Mary and Martha's house, but nevertheless we know that they're in the town where Lazarus, Mary and Martha live. So we don't really know whose house they're at, but Mary, Martha and Lazarus are there. And it's the week before Passover. In between the time where Lazarus has been raised from the dead, which happened last week, Tim spoke about that last week, Jesus and his disciples have gone away to a town near the desert for a little while to have a bit of, to kind of hide away and retreat there because Jesus' life was at risk. So I'm not quite sure what the time frame was in between Lazarus being raised and this dinner happening, but let's say that, you know, perhaps it's a few weeks. So in the other stories, it talks about a woman coming in with an alabaster jar of expensive perfume and breaking it over Jesus' head. In the book of John, it doesn't talk about her breaking the oil over Jesus' head, but it talks about her pouring it on his feet. And there are, you know, what can be seen as inconsistencies in stories that are told in different books of the Bible. But I think it's just too important. It's important to remember that these are different people's it's their views of what happened. And, you know, any of us will know that if we're at a party or a dinner party or hanging out with friends and something happens and we tell that story, that if another person that was there tells that story, they're going to emphasise different details. So when you come across those, what seems like inconsistencies in the Bible, they're not necessarily inconsistencies. It's just that it's a person's point of view. So John hasn't mentioned about the oil on Jesus' head in his version of the story. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. You know, maybe she broke it on his head and his feet. Sorry, I've just got to find my place. In the other stories, they also don't name Judas as specifically being the person protesting the use of the perfume. Simply says that some of those present were saying, "Why this waste?" But Jesus defends the woman, who is Mary, saying, "She poured the perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. I tell you the truth, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." And straight after this is when Judas goes to the chief priest to betray Jesus. Now, there is another account in Luke. I hope I'm not jumping around too much. In Luke chapter 7, where a woman who has lived a sinful life washes Jesus' feet with her tears and pours expensive perfume on them. There's protests at this time as well. However, they are about Jesus letting this kind of woman touch him. And Jesus defends this woman and explains to Simon that people who've been forgiven much love much. And this contrasts the lack of courtesy that Simon has shown Jesus. Simon didn't even offer Jesus any water to wash his feet, which is what happened in those days. People had dirty feet, and it was a common courtesy to have a bowl of water for that person to wash their own feet. But Simon didn't bother to do that when Jesus came over for dinner. So Jesus says, "Hey, you didn't even offer me water, but this woman has not stopped crying and kissing my feet since I got here." So there's a bit of disagreement between scholars and people that study this stuff about whether this was the same story or not, but most people think that this was a different situation. But she was also called Mary, so that's really confusing. So this Mary, the Mary that had the sinful life, she's generally known as Mary Magdalene, and this Mary that we're talking about tonight, who is the sister of Lazarus and Martha, is known as Mary of Bethany. So I'm going to tend to presume that it's not the same situation. But again, if it is, Luke's given a pretty different account of what's happened. Okay, so back to John 12. So Jesus has taken his disciples away and now they've come back and it's the week leading up to Passover. There's a dinner in Jesus' honour. Martha is serving and Lazarus is at the table with Jesus. And, you know, the Bible doesn't have Lazarus saying anything. I don't think that he's quoted as saying anything at all. It's always Mary and Martha are the ones chattering away. But he's a pretty key figure because he's died and been raised from the dead and now he's at this dinner. So I just kind of wonder, what's going on in Lazarus's head sitting at this table having dinner with Jesus? I just wonder whether he's quite spun out about the whole thing. and how much he even remembers or understands about the fact that he was dead and he's been raised again. But, you know, there's crowds of people looking for Jesus and wanting to see Lazarus. So Lazarus's whole life has completely changed. For all we know, he was this quiet guy just getting on with his life, got sick, died, and now he's been raised from the dead and he's like a celebrity and his life's at risk. So everything's just been completely turned upside down for Lazarus. So the chief priests and Pharisees have given orders that if anyone found out where Jesus was, they should report it so that he could be arrested. So anybody who was hanging out with Jesus must have known that it meant trouble. There was high interest and fascination with Jesus, and it would have meant that people who were close to Jesus were having to make decisions about what they believed about him and whether they were prepared to be associated with him. So I would think that the fact that they were holding a dinner in Jesus' honour, knowing that the community leaders were saying, if anybody sees Jesus, we need to arrest him, that was a pretty bold thing for them to be doing. And everything gets around pretty fast. So they're having this dinner, but word soon spreads. Lazarus and Jesus are at dinner. So crowds of people are coming in to see Jesus and trying to get close to him. And not just to see Jesus, but to get close to Lazarus, to see this miracle in action. So at some point in the evening, Mary takes a pint of pure nard and pours it on Jesus' feet, wiping his feet with her hair. And Jesus says that it was intended that this perfume should be saved until the day of his burial. In Mark, it says that she poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Now, a pint of pure nard was, as it says in the verse, it was worth about a year's wages. So it was very, very precious. It was very, it was worth an awful lot of money. It would have been saved for a really special occasion. Perhaps it was some kind of inheritance. Perhaps it was meant to be for her wedding day. We're not sure, but it was probably the most precious thing that she had available. And it seems that Mary might have had some kind of insight that Jesus' death was near. We're not really sure. The way that Jesus talks about it, it seems like he's saying that, that she poured this perfume on my body to prepare me for my burial. It seems like that maybe she had some kind of understanding that not everyone else had caught on to, that Jesus would be dying. And if she didn't, she was doing a prophetic act. She was compelled to do this gesture, which Jesus understood the significance of. It was pretty full-on thing what Mary did. Would have had a very, very strong scent to it, and everyone there would have understood. Everyone knew what this nard was. They all knew that it would have been worth a fortune. And they knew that it was a really big deal that she was doing this. Now, often people interpret Mary's actions as kind of inappropriate and quite full on and maybe even a bit erotic, because in that culture women just didn't undo their hair and wipe their hair everywhere. I mean, that's kind of something that's pretty foreign to our culture. We don't really understand it, and I admit that I've had to be studying the Bible the last couple of days and, Googling and reading and ringing people and trying to get my head around it a little bit, because this just isn't something that we're familiar with in our culture. And so sometimes we kind of miss the significance of it. But I think it was I don't think that it was an erotic, full-on kind of inappropriate thing for her to be doing, but it was definitely a very, very intimate thing to do. She was making herself vulnerable. It was very extravagant and probably quite an emotional thing to do. Presuming that maybe she did have some kind of insight that Jesus was going to be dying soon, it's a pretty appropriate thing to, often if someone's, if anybody's ever spent time with someone that's near death, whose death is coming up, it's a pretty common thing that you would touch that person, that you would stroke that person's face or their hands or their feet and kind of really connect with that person through touch. It's a way of connecting with people and showing compassion and bringing comfort and, whereas in other circumstances you might not do something like that. If you know that someone if someone's going to be dying. It's a totally different situation. So, you know, my personal perspective on this, I don't think that she was being all raunchy and, I don't know, and inappropriate, but it was, you know, very vulnerable and a very intimate thing to do. And, you know, the Bible talks a lot about our relationship with God being really intimate and intimate like lovers. And, you know, it's just, I think, you know, it's true that our relationship with God, it's very, very intimate. And, you know, it doesn't mean that it's, it's an expression of just showing that closeness and that intimacy. So we know from earlier stories that Mary has a close relationship with Jesus. In Luke 10, verse 38, it tells the story of Mary sitting at Jesus' feet while Martha prepares the meal, and Martha gets real cranky because Mary's not helping out. And when Martha protests, Jesus says, "No, what Mary's chosen is better, and it won't be taken away from her." So Mary loved Jesus. She knew Jesus. She was sitting at his feet, which implies that she was being taught and was perhaps a disciple. Now, not one of the 12, but there were a lot of disciples and people who were following Jesus, who were wanting to be near him, who were wanting to be taught by him, who were in his close circle of friends. So the fact that there's two stories involving Mary where Jesus defends her, I think it says that there's something that we need to learn from her. You know, we learn that Jesus is more interested in us wanting to spend time with him and worship, and that the doing and the busy stuff, that comes after. You know, there's nothing wrong with doing things and serving like Martha was, but Martha just had her priorities a bit mixed up. So in contrast to Mary's response of really over-the-top, extravagant worship, you know, really honouring Jesus and doing probably the thing that, you know, thinking, how can I most honour Jesus? And just going with that. We don't know if it's something that she planned to do, that she thought about beforehand, you know, dinner was for Jesus to honour him, or whether it was a really spontaneous action. We don't know those details. But in contrast, Judas has this reaction where he just says, well, what a waste. You know, what a waste. It was worth a year's worth of wages, and we could have given that to the poor. So we don't really know where that comes from, that reaction. John's pretty clear of what he thinks, that Judas didn't care about the poor, but that he was a thief. He actually used to take care of the money for all of the disciples. That was, you know, a privileged responsibility that he'd been given, which meant that he would have been able to give money to the poor wherever they were going, distribute that money as needed. But it seems that he also liked to take a little bit for himself. So Judas has this reaction, and, you know, whether it highlights his own heart and he gets defensive, or whether he just can't see the worth of Jesus and just sees it as an absolute waste. You know, I kind of wonder whether... I don't think Judas didn't get who Jesus was. He didn't get it. You know, I think perhaps he enjoyed the notoriety of being one of the disciples and getting to share with the poor. But maybe he'd never worked out who Jesus really was. You know, he called Jesus teacher, but he'd never called Jesus Lord. Judas seemed to want the best of both worlds. He wanted to be with Jesus, but he also wanted to be in with the chief priests, and he didn't want to lay his life down. As I said before, anyone who was hanging out with Jesus at this time would have been on edge. They would have been having to think, do I really want to be here? Is this really worth it? I could get killed. I could get thrown in prison. I might never be able to go to the synagogue again. You know, I just imagine that everybody might have been on edge, and I can actually relate to that. I can think, well, that's pretty understandable, really, that you'd be placed in this position where you'd have to be deciding. You'd have to be thinking, well, what do I think about Jesus right now? Because if I'm going to stay here and be with him, then I'm putting myself in danger. So I'm just not sure that Judas had ever really worked that out. And when Jesus corrects Judas and says, no, like, she's done to honour me, I'm not going to be here forever, and she's preparing me for my death. You know, Jesus corrects him, and instead of being corrected, Judas seems to make up his mind at that point that he's going to turn Jesus in. So Judas sold Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, which was the price of a dead slave at the time. So if you accidentally killed someone's slave, you would reimburse the slave's owner by giving them 30 pieces of silver. So that's basically what Judas thought Jesus was worth. I'm just going to jump a little bit to talk about Lazarus. I hope I'm not jumping around too much, but there's a lot going on in this passage. In verse 9, we have this large crowd of Jews who found out that Jesus is there, and they want to see him, and they want to see Lazarus as well. So Lazarus is this quiet guy. The Bible doesn't record him really saying anything, but we know that Jesus was close to this family. And when the sisters send word for Jesus and say the one you love is sick, you know, obviously Jesus was really close to Lazarus for them to say that. So I mentioned before that Lazarus's life seems to have really been turned upside down. You know, and I just find it really fascinating that Jesus brought him back to life. But Lazarus, his life is never going to be the same again. Jesus didn't bring Lazarus back to life so that he could just live longer. You know, he's a living testimony of the power of God. And because of that, people are putting their faith in Jesus. So suddenly, Lazarus needs to be killed too, because he's the evidence of Jesus' miracle. So, and I just think, you know, that happens like quite a few times during the Bible. Like, Jesus really impacts people's lives, turns their life around, does an amazing miracle. But that person's life is never the same again. It's kind of ruined in a sense, except it's not ruined. That person has found Jesus. They've found God. They've experienced him. They can see the scales have fallen off their eyes, but there's a really big cost to follow through on that. A few weeks ago, I don't know how many people will remember that Tim was talking about the man born blind. Does everyone remember that? And Jesus heals him with the mud and the spit. So after that happens, the leaders of the community are asking his parents, what happened? Tell us what happened. And his parents, they know what's happened. They know that Jesus has come and healed their son. But instead of saying that, they say, oh, we're not really sure. You better ask him, actually. And it says that they said this because they were afraid that they'd be put out of the synagogue. But then they ask the man who was blind, and he gives testimony. He says, you know, Jesus did it. Jesus came and healed me. And they respond by saying, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out. Which I don't think would have been a small thing at the time to be thrown out of your synagogue. The whole community, everyone went to synagogue. It wasn't just a few people sort of went to church sometimes. Everyone went to the synagogue. They were the rulers of the community. They were really well respected. It would have been a really big thing to be thrown out of the synagogue. So this man has a new life, yet it's a completely different life and not a comfortable one. After he's been thrown out, he meets with Jesus, and Jesus reveals himself as the Son of Man. I imagine that his life is absolutely changed forever, and it's not just because he can see now with natural eyes, but he can see with spiritual eyes. There's other stories where, you know, Jesus heals 10 lepers, only one comes back, he gives praise, and, you know, there's all these different stories where Jesus, has these encounters with people where he raises them from the dead, where he heals them of blindness, where he heals them of leprosy, and it really is up to that person what their response is going to be, whether they say, yeah, it was Jesus and he's changed my life, or whether they kind of go, oh, this isn't good. I'm not really sure what happened. You know, I don't really know who he was. And we all have that. We all have that ability to make that choice. And I think it is easy to come to a faith in Jesus and he kind of fixes up your life a bit and then you just kind of go, thanks for that, and just kind of get along having a nice, better quality life than you once had. But I don't really think, and that's good, you know, he does want to heal us, he does want to restore us, but I think that's when we get into like a real comfortable Christianity where we think that God just came to fix us up so that we could be more comfortable. And that's not what we see happening in the Bible. We see that God is coming and really wrecking people's lives, really just throwing everything up in the air and causing chaos, really. So we have to sort of, you know, I just hope that, you know, in these stories that we can think about who do we identify with in these stories, because I can identify with everyone a little bit. I identify with all these people. You know, and I hope to become more like Mary and Martha and Lazarus, who are really bold in their faith, who say it as it is and who don't really worry about the consequences, but understand that it's a privilege. Like, it is a massive privilege to know Jesus in that way. And I think, you know, when we do die to ourselves and follow him, and when we have a faith that's costly, it's when we find what true life is. That's when we actually find out what it means to have life and to have it to the full. John chapter 1 says about Jesus, he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all those who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling amongst us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. And I just always think that that is so sad when I read that verse. You know, he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world didn't recognize him. And when I think about that scripture, that he, the creator of the universe, made himself man, God sent his son to be flesh and bones on this earth and to show us what he was like, and that the earth didn't even recognize him. You know, when I think about who Jesus is, it doesn't seem excessive what Mary did. Breaking a year's worth, you know, a perfume that was worth a year's worth wages, it does not seem excessive for one second when you understand who Jesus is. And that's the thing, when we look in these natural eyes, when we're blinded and when we're not understanding who Jesus is, what Judas says kind of makes sense. You know, oh, what a waste. Gosh, that could have been put to good purpose. You know, even though we know that his motives were actually wrong, we can kind of relate to that and go, gosh, yeah, a lot of things could be done with a year's worth of wages. But, you know, there is a time for honouring, and Jesus is about to die and give his life for all of humanity. And, you know, whether Mary fully grasps that that's about to happen or not, she's grateful, she's thankful, she's got her brother back, she knows Jesus, she understands who he is, and, you know, I think she believes that he's the Messiah. So I guess today, like, I don't want to do guilt trips. I don't do guilt trips. I don't believe in them. Just don't think that they help. But I just hope to encourage you to allow yourself to have a costly faith, to allow yourself to be ruined, to allow, you know, to trust God with those things, those areas of your life that you hold on to. Preparing for tonight, I've had to really consider, well, what's been costly about following Jesus for me? Like, I've never given him anything that's worth a year of my wages, or I can't think of anything that I've done that's been extravagant like Mary has. I wish that I could, but I don't have that story. I made a decision to follow Jesus when I was 19, although I'd always grown up with a head knowledge of God. Life was about wanting to live my way and getting what I wanted out of life. I felt like I was always desperately hoping that things would work out, but had no assurance that it would. And then at the same time, I did have this hunger for God. I had a hunger for spiritual things. I wanted to know God in a way that was just more than sort of some stories. So I had had other supernatural experiences, which I'm not going to go into tonight, but I'd experienced some weird things that that made me really hungry, but didn't, that kind of, I was like, wow, oh my gosh, the spirit realm is real, but really left me wanting. It never fulfilled me. It never gave me that wholeness that I was after. And so I guess I thought that if God was real, he could beat those other experiences that I had. And I kind of cried out to God and gave him an ultimatum, which was pretty raw and disrespectful when I look back on it. But, God didn't give me some super, like, amazing, supernatural, out there experience like I was hoping for. But, he spoke to me in a quiet, still voice. I will show myself to you by changing you. And that was really the first time that I understood that to know God, which I'd gotten to a point where I was like, God, I want to know you. If you're real, then I want to know you. And it was the first time that I really understood that to know Jesus and to know God and to follow him, it meant that you didn't get to be in charge of your own life. And for a really long time, I'd been wanting to run my own life and know God too. And I, from my understanding, those things just, they just don't go together. So as I've allowed him to change me and shape my life and lead me, I do believe I've gotten to know him more. I see his hand at work in my life and I experience his peace. And I have reached points in my life where I've not been sure that I wanted to follow anymore. Had quite a big crisis last year where I just didn't know whether I was willing to trust him anymore. And it was a massive crisis because I had to make a decision and I had to decide. I think sometimes we get to those points, those crossroad points where we have to decide whether we're going to keep going or not. And we just have to journey those things out. We don't know what disappointments we're going to face in life. We don't know what tough things we're going to come up against. We don't know what's ahead. And, I think a trap that I kind of fell into was thinking that God kind of owed me. Like I'd kind of served him and tried to be obedient and now I felt disappointed and that he owed me. And that was just something that I had to, I had to get past. And it's really been God's grace and great friends who've got me through those times. I really recommend having good friends and making yourself accountable to people. But there's this real place of letting go of control and saying, God, you can be in charge. And, for me, I feel that there's been times when God said, I want you to give me the things that are most precious to you, the dreams that are most precious to you, the things that you hold most dear. I want them. And they've been my special times with God and my deepest moments of worship where I've said, okay, there's this dream or there's this thing in my heart that I want so badly and I'm going to give that over to you. For me, that's all I can really think of that's been really costly, and it'll be different for every single person here. What it means, I was trying to come up with a modern day analogy of, an equivalent of breaking the nard on Jesus's head and feet. But I can't, because I don't think it's the same as just handing over a year's worth of your wages. I think it was more than that. I think it represented a lot more than that, and, it was very symbolic what she did. And it wasn't just that she gave something away that was very generous, but she gave herself. She humbled herself. She washed his feet. That was something that a slave did, a servant slave. So in her doing that, she was making herself like a slave. It was a very meaningful act that she did. And she was preparing him for burial. She was making a proclamation. And, in other areas in the Gospels coming up to Jesus' death, the disciples are freaking out and they're saying, no, Jesus, that'll never happen to you. They're holding on to him. And I just wonder whether Mary, I just wonder, it's just a thought, whether Mary did get it, where she was like, oh my gosh, Jesus is going to die. And even though in her human love and passion for Jesus, she would have been wanting to hold on to him with everything that she had, that she does this prophetic act that says, I'm preparing you for your death and I want to honour you and love you, but I understand that I'm preparing you for your death It would have absolutely broken her heart to do that if she did understand that. And so I can't come up with a modern equivalent, but, you know, Jesus asked different things of all of us. And we all have different things that we know. We know whether we're, if we're holding back. And, you know, we can't just become these super Christian, amazing people by ourselves. But, you know, God sent the Holy Spirit to help us. You know, to help us to make those choices, you know. And when we feel like we can't do it anymore and we feel like we're just not willing anymore, that we can get on our knees and be honest with God and say that and say, God, change me, you know, break my stubborn heart, you know, change me. So, yeah, I guess I just pray that we'd all be able to be those people that have a costly faith, you know, who are real with God, and, you know, when there's a time that a response is needed from us, that we'll be the kind of people that do it. And we'll count the cost early so that we don't freak out like Judas did, you know. And he realised as soon as he did it, he'd made a massive mistake, but he'd never worked out what he believed about Jesus beforehand, and he'd never worked out what price he was willing to pay. You know, maybe he was just ill-prepared and he had sin in his life. He had pride in his life. He got to hang out with Jesus and be real popular, and that he also wanted to be in with the chief priests. And you can't have it all both ways. You know, sometimes, you know, we're not always going to be hated for following Jesus. You know, most of the time people will think we're quite nice. Yay, that's good. You know, hopefully most people we'll think you're quite nice, but, you know, you don't always get to be popular, and you have to make those decisions beforehand that if people are going to hate you, or if persecution comes, or if God asks you to do something that's costly, are you prepared? And you have to make those decisions before the time comes. Otherwise, you know, you might just, you know, make a really bad decision. So I might just pray, and I'm going to ask the worship team to just come up and just play a song, and yeah, just hope that everyone will just, yeah, respond in a way that's meaningful to you. So Lord, I just thank you. I thank you for tonight, God. I thank you for every single person in this room, and I thank you for your grace, Lord. I thank you that, yeah, that when we fall down, you pick us back up, Lord, and that your heart is that not one of us would be lost, Lord, but that we'd all know you, that we'd all walk with you, God. So Lord, I just pray that you'd help each and every person who's struggling tonight to hand things over to you, to trust you, Lord, that they would, and that they would know that it's in that place that they find true life. Lord, that it is a privilege. Lord, it's a privilege to know you and follow you. In Jesus' name, amen.